Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel. He scores! Cortinel's
beating it! Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
I just heard that. Okay, here we go. Recording in progress. Okay. That's the only... I was so bad with chicks, Russ, at one time. Even Siri wasn't talking to me anymore.
What do you mean so bad one time?
Oh, don't start. Why do you have to start right at the beginning of the show, Russ, the time with hammering me? I'm getting sensitive.
Han Solo.
Oh, stop it. Okay, stop it. Hi again, everybody. Jungle Jim Jerome and old what's-his-face, okay, coming at you with another episode of The Suspendables. Rusty, how are you, Rusty?
I'm good. Everything's going well in the little Cortinel family, other than Brooklyn USC soccer team lost the Pac-12 championship to UCLA the other night. So that was a bit of a downer for us. But other than that, things are going okay.
You know, it's we've got a great guest coming on shortly. Before we do that, Russ, I need to, someone texted me yesterday, and I whipped it up on Twitter because yesterday was November 7th. Okay, we record here on, this is a Monday. The show drops on, you're hearing it on Wednesday. On November 7th, 1997, the LA Kings signed free agent right winger Russ Cortinel to a one-year contract. Oh boy, they believed in you. In 1997-98, Cortinel scored 12 goals, 18 points in 58 games, and led the Kings with 4 shorthanded goals.
That's right.
Huh?
Yeah.
Another sign that you're a selfish prick trying to score shorties all the time. Okay.
Yeah. Leaving the zone too early.
Anyway, congratulations, Rusty. That's a big, you're going back 24 years.
Yeah. I saw that on Instagram. I ended up playing 2 years there, not 2 full seasons, but it was, as I called it, the farewell tour.
Yeah, sure. The rocking chair tour, but it was a little early. Yeah.
My bags made a curfew every night on the road, but I might not have.
This buddy here, Dennis Mitchell, Russ, he grew up with you at the Racquet Club. Jeff was his idol.
Mitchie.
Yeah, everyone was going to be, and everyone knew he was going to be awesome at 10 years old. You're that good. Ask him about the night. And I think you might've talked about the, ask him about the night, him, Jeff, Bruce, Brad Palmer, myself and Mike Shannon went to the Keg on the weekend and it turned into a shit show.
Oh fuck. We did talk about that little 2 week suspension for yours truly from the Keg.
Love that story. Lots of stories to tell. He's been very good to my dad over the years, tickets to the games in other cities, Toronto, Montreal, Boston. I was a teacher's aide at the time, and he came to school to talk to the kids I was involved with. Always had time to pay it forward. So that's nice little thoughts about you.
Thanks. Yeah, Dennis was a hell of a hockey player, too. He was one of those guys that, you know, when you played when you were younger, who didn't make it, but was a very talented, really good hockey player and a great teammate. A lot of fun with him.
You have a... cool. Yeah, good to hear. Another story of a guy who never made it. Who loved the show. That would be me, Rusty. I had talent, Rusty. I did.
Yeah, we see it once a week.
Yeah, we see. You live the life of Riley. It's fantastic. We love living through you, Russ, in your illustrious life. Gosser Ranch is a big part of that. You're part of the development of that whole place. You're part of the team that's selling it. And when we started doing this show, we love to bring on guests, and we've had extraordinary guests. And you said to me a while ago, we got to bring on Bobby Ryan.
Yeah.
And I said, for sure, man, for sure. And today's the day. Bobby, welcome to the show, man. Did you
Thank you. Thank you guys. Yeah. Finally get me on. He's been sending me clips for a couple of years, but yeah. Like, fuck, I wonder if he's ever going to ask.
Yeah. Well, there we go.
Bobby and I talked about doing the show from the tree bar. We thought it'd be a lot of fun, but that tree bar is 24/7. So we could never get it to ourselves.
Yeah, no. You gotta be there at 7 o'clock in the morning if you want it to yourselves. It's somewhere between the shift change.
and if you're with Rusty, you gotta stay till 4 in the morning. Okay, yeah, there's no one and done here going out. Bobby, if people don't know you're who you are, I mean, you got a great career. I didn't realize this. Stevie, our producer back in Ottawa, was telling me I forgot that you were drafted so high, second overall behind Sid Crosby.
I would have
retired as soon as I got drafted. That's good enough. Okay.
The gap only got bigger after the draft. I wasn't closing any gaps.
Tell us about about your getting drafted. There's so many great things we want to talk about in your life and your personal side too. That's well documented, but let's start there. Let's start there with drafting.
Yeah. Oddly enough, 2004 was that lockout year. So we went through that entire year not knowing if there was going to be a draft. Kind of like the last lockout, it was just kind of a spur of the moment. I think we found out a week or two in advance there was the lottery and then the draft. And turns out it was in Ottawa. So it was a full circle for me that I got to end up going to play there. But a very different kind of draft. It was in a ballroom, not an arena. So I had four people there plus my agent, and very small. But what a great day. I guess it's kind of your first step to playing in the National Hockey League, right? Mm-hmm. Overall. So to go and be drafted high and by a team that I really wanted to go to when I went through the process with Brian Burke and everybody in Anaheim, I was pretty pumped that they took me there. And got a chance to experience that city a little bit. And then it was great. The drinking age was 18 right across the bridge. So got to go enjoy that a little bit. I remember I had to throw the first pitch at the Ottawa Lynx baseball game the next day at noon. And I was like, oh no, I was like, if I close my left eye and get this going over the top, I should get it there.
That's awesome.
And then I had to drive 8 hours to Owen Sound, Ontario. And I'll never forget that drive. I was like, it's only another 6 hours. Just windows down and head out the window the whole way.
Listen, don't kid yourself, Bobby. What makes a great NHLer? Mark Messier. This past weekend was a great weekend in Edmonton because they retired Kevin Lowe's number and all those guys were in town, Paul Coffey and Gretz and Yari Curry, and a whole whack of guys.
Just those
small little characters in the NHL. And Mess used to say, one of the toughest things about being an NHLer is during practice. Okay. And you're skating around at, in the warm-up and the coaches are standing in the corner and you're absolutely hung like a fucking rabbit. That when you got to learn how to skate, when you're skating to your left, you got to learn how to turn your head right so the coaches don't smell the scotch. That's it. when you're whipping around.
See, I got the benefit of knowing what the old guys did and then inventing your own trick. So I used to put peanut butter in like it was a chew so I didn't smell peanut butter.
No, you didn't.
That's the first. That's the first.
Yeah.
Why didn't I think of that, man?
That's beautiful.
I was like, I can't impart it. As you get older in the league, especially, you're like, I'm a bit of a role model now for these young guys. And that was wisdom that I did not impart. Maybe teach them about day-to-day life, but not that one.
I played with Dave Semenko at the end of his career in Toronto. And I used to pick him up or drop him off at his condo. And he'd be practicing chewing on gum. And he'd take the gum out of his mouth and say in front of everybody, this gum's a losing battle. It's just never going to work. Out goes the gum. Just so hungover.
What was the story? We were talking off air, Stevie, you remember from your Ottawa days. And you guys played in a golf tournament or something a few years ago. And I've heard this roar. You were talking about some famous picture. I don't know if can it be told. Maybe I'm throwing you under the bus.
Yeah. I didn't know if Stevie was going to weigh in. Sorry. Yeah. Nothing bad or anything. I played with Steve, Lever Sage, and I'm drawing a blank on the fourth, but, it was a charity golf tournament. It's always the day or two before training camp. So, you know, it's not a drinking tournament by any means. It is for those guys, but for us, we got fitness testing in 2 days. So, you know, you might've had a beer or two, over the course of the day, but there's a famous picture of that. I mean, this guy just got absolutely roasted on Twitter and all the social media, because you do that group picture, you know, where I stand in the middle, or you do the thing with the golf club in front, make it official. Sure. And this, you got three pretty tall guys. And then this poor Lever Sage, height challenged, I guess is the word you're looking for now. So they take the picture, and it's like the guy's floating because he's on his tippy toes, right? Just like, he's just trying to get up to my shoulder blade here. And whoever, I don't know who tweeted the original picture, but they're like, the first person to pick it up, and then it went viral. It was viral in Ottawa, but it was incredible. And the amount of verified blue check marks that were weighing in on this thing were just, you guys are going to have to get it and get a copy of the picture. But it became a running joke. So every time I would come across them, I'd be like, I got to get that thing blown up. I need that on a canvas. I need that best on a canvas pop. But yeah, the poor guy just absolutely assaulted online. Yeah.
Well, I worked with Versace, as we called him, Lever Sage. And he's one of those guys you do like to pick on. So I'm good. I'm gonna find that freaking picture.
Oh yeah, that'll be easy to find.
But that's the worst when you get to those tournaments and you're like, okay, you never know who you're gonna get, right? It's either a blind draw or they draft players or whatever it might be. So you're just like, okay, it's gonna be a 5.5 hour round. You hope you get a good group. And then I got the radio and the media guys, and immediately I was like, uh-oh, right? Because then you kind of got to be on guard, even though they're, you know, everything's off the record and you're playing. And I honestly can't remember a more fun group that I had in the tournament. We had a great day.
There's the picture.
Yeah. Oh, there it is. There he is.
Stevie just sent it to me.
No, he is standing on his toes.
Oh, is he ever? He's almost out of his shoes.
That's what I remember. Oh, I told him, I was like, take those things off and flip them upside down and stand on the spike.
Square that up to the camera a little better, Russ, so we see it. Let's see. We may hang just on, go
I was
with this.
Just going to send it. To...
No, down. Right there. That's perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I'm going to send it to you guys.
Oh, that's great.
You heard at the top of the show, Bobby, before we talk about other things, Rusty getting in some trouble at the keg. Okay. Him and his two brothers. Well, you know, Jeff, of course. And
Brad Palmer.
And Bruce, you probably know. He's been down to Gosser. These guys were shit disturbers in their own town, Bobby. Okay. In their own town, Russ was constantly getting in trouble. He always says, if you talk about these stories, right? We love these stories, and there's always something that happened. Okay. A fight, or they got kicked out or something like that. And Russ always goes, yeah, well, that was Jeff and Bruce, right? That was Jeff and Bruce. you must have when you jumped into the league, Bobby, you must have some great stories when you started. How about your first pro game? First time you stepped on the ice, getting a paycheck to be a hockey player.
I guess my first pro game, I had two really good runs with the Portland Pirates, the AHL team, before I had ever even, I guess, officially turned pro. You would finish your junior season, go to wherever the NHL team dictated where to go. So Rusty, I mean, you guys will all know the names. I got pulled out of Owen Sound, Ontario. We lost on like a Wednesday. They were starting game one on Friday, and they were the one seed. So they had a great year and a great team. Kevin Dineen was coaching, who is still my favorite coach of all time. Just one of the best people I've ever met. So I get there, and I get like a 7 a.m. flight. So I'm getting down there, and I'm like, there's no way I'm playing tomorrow. These guys are the one seed. And, you know, other guys are like, you're the second overall pick, big guy, you're playing. So then I always hated messing up with those team dynamics, because you got a one seed team. You would think that they want to keep that original lineup, but no, they throw me in. So the guys on this team, you got Shane O'Brien, Pierre Parento, Zdeněk Knopka, Timmy Brandt, Ryan Shannon, Bruno St. Jocks. Like this was a very good hockey team, but my God, my first pro practice was eye opening. We're just days before I guess these guys were on, they had such a good amount of time off that it was like Dineen said, see you guys in 3 days. The guys were coming down. I'm just Curtis Glencross. I'm just sitting in my stall like this, you know, kind of looking around. You got guys that are so hungover that they're wrestling 45 minutes before practice. You got Dustin Penner's doing drops off the thing, off the stalls in the locker. And I'm looking around going, this is pro hockey. This is this is different. I had bleach blonde hair. Oh, dude, my hair was bleach blonde because our junior team made us do it. I was like, I'm gonna get lampooned by these guys as soon as I walk in the room. My first pro game, we won 6-0 over Providence, and first game of the series. So the game went from a very good hockey game, and it was 3-0, and it was closer than 3. But all of a sudden, it's 4-5, and I think I assisted on 5 or 6. Goals, not overall, just a 5th and 6th goal.
Humble brag.
Yeah,
that's all right. Humble brag. But I remember after that one, we got back on the bench, and I'll never remember who said it, but there he goes, tighten the chin strap. This one's going to turn.
No. And I was like,
no. Nice. Pardon? And it was like, this game just turned into an absolute shit show. And Kevin Dineen comes down and goes, you're going to play grocery stick for the rest of this game. And I was like, thank fuck. Like, part of my language. I was a day out of juniors, right? I was like, I'm looking around and I'm just going, my God, I think Nate Thompson might have been on the other team at that time. But it was a bloodbath the rest of the way. And then that series, I was like, we play these guys again tomorrow? Like, it's a back-to-back? It's like, is everybody going to dress? That was eye-opening, but as a first career game. But we ended up losing in game 7, double overtime, the conference finals to Hershey with Bruce Boudreaux was like kind of in his last year there before he made the jump. And I remember that was some of the most fun I had playing hockey because those guys, we had 6 days off between games 6 and 7.
Oh my God.
Yeah, because it had to be in Hershey. The circus was in town. They wouldn't move to neutral site. So
the circus or the circus?
Yeah,
yeah,
the circus. Yeah, it turned into both, but I was like, so
Obi would have gained 10 pounds in those 6 days.
That's what it is. Yeah. Well, I was like, we drove the bus down. It was a long bus ride. It was 2 buses or whatever. And I'm like, man, I know how I felt. But I had played considerably more games because I went to World Juniors, World Junior Camp that year, mm-hmm. You know, a playoff run in Owen Sound that ended pretty early. But at the same time, I was gassed. We get down there and the guys go out for dinner and my roommate comes back at like 11:30, just pinned. And I was like, we just had 6 days. We just had 6 days. And, but that was, I mean, it's changed so much, but that was life in the American Hockey League back then. That was 2005 or right. 6. So, a lot's changed. It's not quite like that anymore, but, I had a very, very eye-opening at first experience in the American League.
who wouldn't like a coach when they go, I'll see you in 3 days, yeah. Boys, get back to the rink.
Well, yeah, so he did that after game 6 too. He's like, well, I mean, we're not going to get better at this time of year, so take two full days. And guys went to the University of Maine, and I was like, I'm staying at the Holiday Inn Express. I was like, I got nowhere to go. I'm making $26 a day. I had no signing bonus, so I had to eat every meal at a 50% off play. So I was like, can we just play this game and let's go? But it was fun. I had a blast.
You must play with Kevin Dineen, Russ.
Yeah. So Kevin and I played on Team Canada in 1984. And we went to the Olympics in Sarajevo. There was a Mark Morrison, another guy, weren't disqualified because they played like 8 games in the NHL. So yeah, I did play with him. And man, what an energizer bunny that guy is. Yeah. Unbelievable. Like,
yeah. And cool.
And he actually got better when he got into the NHL. Like this guy, in my opinion, just got better and better and better and became a hell of a goal scorer and was tough for his size. Like he could go really good player.
I grew up a Flyers fan. So I grew up a Kevin Dineen fan and, I was at the US selection camp, for the 2006 or 2007 World Junior team. I can't remember, but it was in Lake Placid and I was already drafted. So it must've been my first camp and I got hurt in the last game. I ended up missing my first entire NHL training camp because of it with a shoulder injury. And I was tired from the camp and Kevin Dineen called and said, hey, I live about halfway there between home and there. And I know you're driving. Why don't you stop over for dinner? And I was 19. So I stopped over, got to meet his family, his brother, who I ended up playing for as well. And in the morning I was just kind of got up, I was prepared to drive and he said, oh no, we're going to go out on the boat. I said, oh, okay. Guy made me swim the lake with a shoulder injury. There you go. Right? So he told me I had to work off the beers. I said, I had one beer at dinner. And he said, no, you're swimming the lake. And
then
And then he goes, do you have a chew? Because he knew I chewed. I said, yeah. And I don't think his wife knew he chewed at the time way back when. So I had to give him a chew, and he was in a rowboat behind me while I'm swimming the lake. And I'm just going, what the? God damn it. I knew I should have kept driving last night. but the best coach I ever had. I loved him.
That's great to hear.
We often, Rusty, we're really fortunate with Russ's career and where he played and how long he played. And of course, two of the big cities were Toronto and Montreal, who anyone who listens to any sort of hockey loves to hear those stories from the great days. But Russ has, and every other guy we've had on who played for Montreal talks about how crazy it was to play in those cities, that it's a different deal. And yet you played in Anaheim, where arguably it wouldn't be known as a hockey hotbed. What was it like there?
I loved it. Yeah, I loved it because I've always been somebody that enjoyed the anonymity from hockey. So there was nothing you couldn't do in Orange County, California. You could do whatever you wanted and nobody knew. I remember when they won the cup, it wasn't on the first page. Like it was just a different vibe. You know, we had a little Newport Beach crew. And when I started, I started on the oldest team in the league. So you got the Prongers and those guys that didn't live down there, but you had myself, Matt Bolesky came in a year later, Brett Festerling started with me. So we had a good group that you could honestly park your car and never touch it again until you went to the rink. We drove bikes right along the beach to every restaurant. I lived a step off the sand. I loved that. So we had this thing where, one of us would cook dinner. The other guy would go get appetizers just down the road. And then we always had to put dinner on the back burner because the other guy'd be like, hey, appies are taking a little longer and you might want to come check this out. So it was like, God damn it. So Cabo Cantina got us a few times down there. But it was my favorite experience playing hockey in a city. And that's not to slight the other ones. I loved California. The weather, the only downside would be the commute every day, can get a little wearing with traffic, but, the fans are equally as passionate there as everywhere else I played. They really get behind the team, and when things are going good, it's one of my favorite buildings still to play in.
Bobby, did you win a cup there, or were you just after?
Just after, yeah, just after, yeah. Okay. So I was a black ace for a bit there during that run, and then went home and watched from the couch, and then started the very next year there.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
I was the I was the books, not the bookends in Montreal.
you had a lot more games to take at it, to take a chance at it. I don't know how long does it take to get over. You'll have to tell me that someday.
Yeah. How many games have you played so far?
We were looking the other day. It was 870, I think, give or take. Yeah. And then, you know, in Ottawa, I had that run of injuries that they were freak injuries with the hands. And then of course I took some personal time. So I think right around 1,000 was where I was going to be, unfortunately, right. But, you know, it is what it is.
I broke my ankle. I got a slap shot in the ankle, in San Jose, and I was like 20 games shy of getting my 1,000th game, and the media start talking about Jeff and I were going to be the first two brothers ever to play 1,000 games. And it became a huge deal, and a huge deal for Jeff and I, two kids from Victoria, BC, who would have thought with all the brother combinations, we had no idea, that two brothers hadn't played 1,000 each. And so I break my ankle and I go, oh my God, this is it. I'm not going to get there. And then I get back, I'm healthy, but I'm playing like shit. And Larry Robinson's our coach in LA, and Greeny, our assistant, comes up to me and says, hey, Larry wants to know what the fuck's wrong with you, 'cause you're playing like shit. And I said, Greener, we're going to be the first brothers ever to play 1,000 games. I just got to get across the finish line. Just get me to 1,000 and then I'll be good after that. And so those 10 games prior to my 1,000th,
like Larry understood how important it was to up me and everybody else. And so, anyways, I got over the 1,000 mark, but it wasn't easy. I can relate to players like yourself who, you know, you're there, you're close. And with a few, you know, you got lockouts and you've got this and that and injuries and it happens, but you know, we can talk more about or talk about what your future holds, but hopefully you get your 1,000th, buddy.
We'll see. I'm not, I haven't given up on it yet.
Attaboy.
You talk about Anaheim being the best experience. I get that too. You know, you don't want to offend other towns that you played in Detroit or Ottawa. You had, our research department is very sharp. Stevie just sent me, you had 4 30 goal seasons in a row, back to back to back to back. And yet Anaheim traded you. Can you take us inside that, what you felt, what you thought, and what they thought of why they traded you?
Yeah, well, I think at the end of the day, it's a small market team and they have an internal cap. And, you know, you just signed Getzlaff and Perry, rightfully so, to the, I guess they were 8x8, give or take, big time contracts. I was the only forward left on the roster that they could move that was making a significant sum. You know, to move money out, for them to, you know, give them a chance to get deeper without spending 5-on-1, you could spread it across 2 kind of thing. And, we knew it was coming. We just weren't sure when. I think I went into that off season fully expecting it to happen, but as the later it gets, the more you're starting to, you know, have hope that you're going back to where you want to be. So they called, I remember on July 5th, they called me and let me know. And, I think I was past the point of being offended. I think you learn how to understand that it's, you know, that it was going to be me, because at that point, your first line was going to be 8-8 and 5-5. That's, you know, it's hard to build a team when you got 3 guys making that, with an internal cap. Mm-hmm. So we're just waiting for the call. And then, thought about throwing my phone in the Snake River in Idaho and just showing up to camp, but, they found a way to get a hold of me. And, you very quickly go from disappointment to excitement, because then you talk to the other team and how pumped they are for it. So I was able to switch out of Anaheim mode pretty quickly and start getting ready for Ottawa.
The honeymoon's awesome. Yeah. When they love you.
Yeah.
We can't wait.
Yeah. Get this guy to a 7-year deal. Okay. And then boom.
What'd you think of Ottawa and your days there, Bobby?
Oh, it was awesome. It was good. I will say Kanata is pretty far from Ottawa where you're living and playing. And I think that's the only place that they get knocked on. I mean, other guys would text me from the hotel and be like, this is the worst place in the world. I'm like, well, honestly, Ottawa, the city is great. The downtown market, the Little Italy, like all those places, the food scene, everything's good. You just got weather and distance out there. And if you can get over those two things, and again, me being the way I was and loving the anonymity, I went even further away and, almost into a little city called Dunrobin, which was way out there, but I was dirt roads to the rink. I love that. Never got on a freeway. You know, had a cul-de-sac that the neighbors didn't care to meet me, which was great. So, if you can, you know, if you can find your ways around the things that in like in any city that are going to bother you, you can have a good experience. So, I did. Ultimately, I had a good experience there.
You talked, that's a few times now you've mentioned about sort of slipping under the radar, protecting your private life. It's not, you know, it's not odd that we hear that once in a while. So I'm gathering that maybe that's one of the things you did not like about playing in the NHL and being a celebrity.
Yeah, I was never my thing. It's funny, you get so many personalities in a locker room that some guys needed it every day to feel justified in that sense. And other guys just didn't want any part of it. And I don't know where I would draw that line for me, but it was certainly something I veered away from. I think, especially when things were going bad, which they did for years there for me with the injuries and then the slumps. I became a bit of a shut-in. And then I became a bit of an alcoholic. I'm not blaming Ottawa on that, right. But, I just never, it got to the point where it's like, okay, drive straight to the rink and straight home. So you don't have to go to the grocery store and, you know, an 80-year-old man tells you, you suck. Like that, I mean, it happened. It was part of it. And everybody in Ottawa, you know, had a way that they thought the team should be and the way that you should be. And that got very wearing for me very quick. So I was able, thankfully, because of where we live, they're able to get away from it. And my wife had to take on more of the shopping role and all the other stuff. And dinners out were few and far between, but that was just, you know, to go there, it was my singular focus had to be hockey and getting away from the rest of it.
It's funny, Bobby, I live in LA and so many people that I've met over the years that are, they've made money and they don't have fame. And I've come across people who would love to be famous. And I always say people want to be famous until they're famous. And all that goes with it, you know, when you're a celebrity and like you said, when you get judged at work because you're a hockey player, and then you go to the coffee shop or the grocery store and people have an opinion, and they feel like because you're such a big part of their life that they just feel like they can give you their opinion. And I've talked to Jimmy about this on the show, that my advice to a lot of hockey players that I come across when they come to retirement, I always say, try to retire in a city that either doesn't have hockey or they don't care about hockey, because it gives you a chance to relax and figure your shit out. And because so many times when players retire, it doesn't matter what sport you're in, but when players retire, they go to get a coffee after dropping their kids off at school. And at the coffee lineup, somebody says, oh, we wish you were still playing. We could have used you last night. What do you think? And you just can't separate yourself and get away. And if you go to somewhere, someplace, they don't give a shit. It's so much easier to deal with everything that we have to deal with when the end does come for a career. So Boris Salming told me a long time ago when I was a kid, he goes that the higher you climb, the farther you fall. So try to stay grounded. Try not to be that guy that needs that attention. And, you know, we've all played with those players that they love it. They can't get enough of it. And those guys have the hardest time when they retire because, man, oh, man, they thrive on that, you know, celebrity status, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, I think I'm very fortunate of the places I picked in Idaho and Franklin, Tennessee, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, us at Gosser, if there wasn't 12 or 14 of us that played in the NHL, none of those members would really care that we played in the NHL.
No, it's so true.
Oh, you guys played in the NHL? Okay, great. So you want to play golf tomorrow? Or you want to come for a barbecue?
Yeah. What's the NHL?
No, that's so true.
You came into Ottawa with the most beloved player, hands down, in Ottawa, because he started with the team when it is Daniel Alfredsson. And you came in probably, Steve and I were just talking about probably as his replacement. And so I can't help but ask, when you talk about your private life, that you're so protective, did you must've felt there's enough pressure on a guy to play in the NHL anyway, but what could that possibly be like when you're kind of touted as the guy who might be his replacement?
Yeah, that it added fuel to everybody else's fire for sure. Critics and fans alike, but it wasn't even a day. It was like hours after he left, they made the trade, I think. So it was, you couldn't help. I mean, there was just no way for me to get away from that comparison. And then the media, the original media session, they brought it up a lot. And then as the first season went on, and I had a great start there in Ottawa before the first injury, that first year, I think it was a point a game through 30 some games, and then ended up with the double sports hernia surgery. Played through that for way too long, and unfortunately it continued to get worse. But as I was going downhill, those comparisons got ramped up, and it was like, this is an apples and oranges situation. This is a guy that's injured, and we're trying not to tell the media how bad it was, right? But I knew going in, I was like, there's no way nobody's ever going to live up to this. And if anybody's got a good chance, it might be a Brady Tkachuk. But that's, to be that beloved, I won't say that the points in those things are going to be the same, but to be that beloved by that franchise, Brady Tkachuk, and probably the only opportunity I would ever see there. So I just tried, I mean, I tried my best to tune it out, but Yeah, I mean, it's hockey in Canada. You flip on the radio and you better hope you have satellite radio. So you can, you're not, because you're like, God damn it. I didn't even know this was a talk show. You know? like Bobby Ryan was minus two last night. I was like, was I? I was like, I didn't even know. I'm sure shit wasn't checking my Corsi or whatever the fuck. All those different stats. Everybody's like, well, you were on the ice and you were in your zone the whole time. And I'm like, I was matched up against Malkin and he's pretty good. I was like, it was only minus two. I'll take that. Guy could have had a night.
Well, of course, you're in the age of analytics. Yeah, I hate the analytics or whatever they're doing.
They're killing the game, man.
Yeah, I think they are too. What's your situation now, Bobby? Are you unrestricted? Still getting paid by Ottawa? How long left? Where any interest? What's happening? Bring us inside that. About your hockey sitch.
I had a nice camp, actually. Things went well in Detroit, and there was, I guess in a grand scheme, there was an opportunity to stay, but nothing that made sense. I don't want to speak for Steve Yzerman. That'd be the worst thing you could do, but I know that he felt like Lucas Raymond had to play and get some games because he had a good camp and he's having a hell of a start. So I couldn't agree more in that sense with him, but it was almost like they wanted me to go into a waiting pattern there in Detroit and stay there and train and skate, but without the promise of a contract. And at this point, I'm a month away from my family almost. I just said, I can't put my family's life on hold. They're in Idaho by themselves. It's time for me to at least get somewhere where I can be with them and start setting up life for after hockey. And if something comes down the chute, then we'll reassess. There was some summer contracts that just didn't make sense as well. I knew at this point in my life, in my career, that it was going to have to be a place that we all settled on together. And none of those places came, unfortunately. So I'm unrestricted free agent. Could go anywhere at any time. And still holding out hope that one of the teams that I was hoping that calls. And if that's the case, try and be ready for that. But right now my focus is on family and I took a school visit today for a 5-year-old, if you can believe that.
Good for you, buddy.
Man, they're walking me through this campus and I'm just like, they're five, you know? This is where we get our meal plan. This is where we get our, here if they need gluten-free needs. And I was like, I thought you just kind of strapped a Lunchable in their JanSport and sent them off. But apparently that's not the case. So that's where I'm at right now. And that's what I'm doing. And then, training every day still, but expectations are low, but you hope for the best.
Rusty, you never told me this guy was so fucking cool.
Yeah, okay, I know.
Like, you're one of the coolest dudes I've ever talked to. Yeah, if it happens, it happens. That's okay. I'm good.
Yeah,
Bobby's a great guy, and we became quick friends up in fast friends in Gosser. And
right,
I like his values. He's Bobby. You're a great guy, and we Bobby and I cooked. He likes to cook. He and I share recipes . When we were at Gosser, like Chaser and I would do, cook for everybody. Bobby and I did a couple times. So we cooked over at Tyler Johnson's house once and over at your place. Yeah. And we hit it off. There's a lot of things about Bobby that reminds me of me. Anyways, we had a lot of giggles and a lot of laughs. Unfortunately, Bobby sold up at Gosser and moved across the lake, which we can still see each other, but I wasn't at Gosser last summer.
That's your fault, Russ.
Yeah, maybe partially, but anyways.
Less Russ and more the tree bar. Yeah, there you
go. We had a few good wine tastings in Bobby's wine cellar. Over the summers and a lot of fun, but Bobby is well versed in his wine and has an incredible collection. And so he shared with me some of the wines I've never tried before, and they're just phenomenal.
Right.
Should we try this one? Should we try that? I'm like, bring it on, bring it on, bring it on. I'm in. I never said no.
Let's do it.
I'm thinking this friendship might have been a one-way street because he did nothing but cost me money at Gosser. Yeah,
exactly.
Are you getting the picture?
Well, that's a problem when you don't have a house. So
Russ gauges his friends on their wine cellar. There's no doubt about it. I mean, he loves everybody and everyone loves Russ. But you'll notice it's like he gave every I go, Hey, Russ, do you know Kelly? Is Kelly chasing it? Oh yeah. Oh yeah. 180 bottle wine cellar, Jimmy. You hang out with Bobby Ryan? Absolutely. Okay. 410 bottles. Okay. No. Best bottles in the world.
4,000. Bobby,
I love it. What makes sports beautiful and what makes it great is the comeback, the story of the comeback. The guy who was down and out, the whole story again is absolutely riveting. Absolutely riveting of what's happened in your life as a young man, as a hockey player, for personal issues. And I'd asked you at the top of the show, can we talk about this? And you said absolutely. And allow me to read a part of this on your early life, Bobby, if that's okay. And then I want to go to that. I wept like a baby. I wept like a baby when I saw Saku Koivu come back from stomach cancer. And when you came back from a personal time away and got a hat trick the night you came back in Ottawa. Ryan was born Robert Shane Stevenson in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and grew up in Collingswood, attending Queen of Haven for grade school. On October 29th, 1997, Ryan's father, Bob Stevenson, badly beat Ryan's mother, Melody, in a drunken rage, leaving her hospitalized with 4 broken ribs, a skull fracture, and a punctured lung. Ryan's father was charged with attempted murder and jumped bail, fleeing to Canada. His wife later forgave him, and she and Bobby joined him in Canada, living under assumed names. It's almost like that's made up, Bobby, when you read that, going, oh, my freaking God. The way kids complain about their life these days, they're kind of, you know, the youth is self-entitled. And then you read this story. How do you even conceptualize a thought of what that was like for you growing up? I'm kind of speechless when I read it, you know, a couple of days ago.
Yeah. I guess I don't know how to conceptualize any other way, because it was just what I went through. So I know a lot of hockey players that I left behind in New Jersey when we went. First it said Canada, which we never actually quite made Canada. We went right to California, but I didn't know any better. I was 11 and 12, so it just made sense that I was with my family. And a lot of players that I left behind that didn't get the same opportunities because they stayed in South Jersey. I guess I don't want to say didn't make it, but didn't make it to the highest level. So for me, this was the only way it made sense. A lot of people don't know that my dad had always intended to turn himself in, but he wanted to get me on the right path for hockey first. And felt like he needed to do that. And I think he did that because he put me in Southern California with 2 of the best coaches in minor hockey at the time. We won 2 national championships. They went on to win a 3rd after I had left. And just honestly, I hate to say it, but it became a huge blessing in disguise that we did that, because it put me in the right place for my hockey career. But the hockey stuff aside, it's hard to conceptualize a term for it or a sentence to put it into words, because it's just what I went through and it's just what I had to learn how to deal with.
You're you became one of a small percentage of hockey players who go into the substance abuse program later on in your career. That comeback I am talking about was for some time away that you took. You had mentioned at the top of the show about being an alcoholic. I'm assuming you're an alcoholic in recovery now. And I have an affinity to all guys like you, because I'm an 11-year clean and sober guy.
Congratulations. Well. Yeah.
So how did what was the breaking point then, Bobby, for you to check out, as they say, and check in?
Check out and check in. Good point. Good way to put it. I guess my last breaking point would have been, it was actually in Detroit with Ottawa. We were on the road and had a day off, and guys went out like you do. I had some errands to run, so I didn't go to the football game, but met up with the guys and, had a normal night out. But I was quickly learning that my nights out were becoming more and more. And then they were leading into 2 days because of, and I actually talked to Russ about this, and we talked about it the day that I left, but just, I had this crippling fear of hangovers, and learned that the best way to get away from that was to get back on the horse, and was finding out that I was doing that. And then, you know, it was just becoming to the point where I just said, I can't continue to live life this way. And that was less professionally, that was more personally for my home life with my wife and two young kids now at this point. And, just decided that if I didn't go right then, the day that I went, that I probably would have chalked this up to another shitty day and a bad experience, and then played the next night and the night after that. And, you know, gone back to the white knuckling way, which, I learned the white knuckling way is the hardest way. Wasn't able to do it any longer. It just wasn't. So I got off the ice and said, get me on a plane. and was in Los Angeles that night.
Bobby, I'll never forget it, because you and I were you started texting me when you were sitting in the, on the plane getting ready to come out to LA, and you and I are buddies. So you just start shooting off texts. We were back and forth. And then I saw you during that time, and we got to spend a day together while you were here, and, you know, it was keeping your privacy. And, you know, I brought you out you came out to Sherwood, and I told the guys, like, okay, no, you know, please, you know, and thank God it was in LA, because no one really cares.
Yeah.
It's fairly normal out here. But, anyways, we had a great day together and a good day to catch up and see how you're doing and stuff. But, I went through that with you, and it was amazing, because I don't think I've ever had anyone. I mean, Jeff, my brother, went through it, but he went through it on his own. You know, he just said, I got to stop. And he stopped, but didn't go get help like you did. And so anyways, that was an incredible couple weeks for sure.
It was. Yeah. I was about halfway through when I said, fuck Russ, I got to go. Like, we got to get me out of here. Just get me a day pass. I was like, I'm not above bribing a single person in this place. I just got to go play golf or something. I got to do anything but sit through another, whatever it might be, a meeting or just anything like that. Cause I knew I had another 15, 16 days to go. And I was like, I need just a mental reload. So yeah, Russ, I got a ride over, and he came and picked me or dropped me back off. And yeah, it was, well, they were all good days there, cause I was learning how to deal with a lot of different things that I had to deal with for a long time. But yeah, getting out and playing some golf and just hanging with a buddy, a hockey guy too, because I wasn't with any hockey guys in there, that's for sure. So
and he birdied 13 yeah. Right in front of my house.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, 9-iron. I'll never forget it.
are you a good golfer, plus, Bobby?
Oh, fuck, is he ever?
Oh, really? Yeah. Really? Oh, that a boy. Good.
I poke it around. Well, the handicap's on its way down pretty quickly right now, so.
Are you like Ray Whitney good?
No. That's few and far between. But I'm going to text Ray after this and let him know that I'm coming. I'm on my way. Good. I'm on my way.
Bobby, I mean, it's great that you, you know, this story of yours for sure. You know, when we record this, it comes on the heels of Carey Price coming back, I think, this week, as I understand, who.
Today.
Yeah. You know, what was it surprising? I mean, nobody's immune, and nobody's immune to alcohol and substance abuse problems, and mental illness. And when Carey Price did that, is it, what's it like when you go to the team, Bobby? Because I would think even the guys in Montreal might say, and a franchise player like that, when he comes in and says, I need some time away. I wonder if they even go, really, dude, can you not just suck it up for a bit? Right. I mean, that's a reality. What's your take on all of that? Are there guys in the league probably more than we think, that are having trouble coming forward, say, with mental health issues?
Yeah, I would assume so. And that's a guess, but I would assume so. And I think that you're going to see, I think you're going to see more of it going forward. It's just going to be, conversations are being had. It's becoming more commonplace to say, hey, like, I mean, you saw Jonathan Drouin, and I only use his name because he was so public about it, that he went through it, last year. And I think you're going to find people that are just going to say, listen, it's time that I address something that's been bothering me for a long period of time. And it doesn't always have to be 30 days or it doesn't always have to go somewhere. Maybe they're just getting help without the program. The program's doing it, but they're not going somewhere to do it. I would assume the phone lines have picked up when you add in COVID and all the other stuff throughout the last year. I think that a year and a half, whatever it is now, I don't know how long we've been in this thing anymore. It just continues to go. But I do think that the phone lines are picking up and chatter's picking up and guys are addressing some issues that they have off the ice for sure. And I wasn't the first, because there's obviously been players in recovery for years and addressing their issues. But what I would say is it's getting easier to come forward and teams are becoming more understanding, because that, you know, I'm a traditionalist and I still think there's a place for the time and place for the old boys club. But not at this point when it comes to mental health and substance abuse. You just have to address those things before they get out of hand.
All hockey players, athletes, are afraid of losing. You know, they're always competing and you're competing against your own teammates at times where you don't want to give anyone the opportunity to take your spot. You know, you're always, until you become that player that you can almost do anything. And there's only a few of those on each team. And I think a lot of players are afraid to admit to an injury, admit to an illness, admit to mental health problems, especially because it's invisible. You don't want to tell anybody anything because you're worried about letting somebody have the opportunity for two games to play in your position. And so this allowing people to come forward is great, but they got to have that level of comfort that they're not going to lose their job. And if they don't have that, you're not going to have people being honest. You know, if you're worried about your job, I mean, fuck, it just sucks, but it's true.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. That's a great point. You're more liable to see first and second guys with a level of comfort come forward than guys that are swing guys, right? Between the American League and the NHL, you're going to see less of that because of the reality that you're generally pretty replaceable. And right, there's a kid playing in the American League right now that's ready to go, and you're going to be out of sight, out of mind, getting help. So I can understand that for sure.
Yeah. I think ironically, it's going to be part of the problem. Then we're going to let you go, man. I think ironically, it's going to be part of the problem with concussion protocol. Right along what you're saying, Russ, that, you know, the fear is if I'm out for a game or two, I might not get back in, you know, and I wonder if that's going to be one of the problems with injury. Who knows? Yeah. But I know what you're saying.
When you're Gary Volk, Bobby in Vancouver, where was I playing?
Gary Volk. Wow.
No, I was playing with Tom Chorsky. I'm playing for the Montreal Canadiens, and Tom decides to fight Gary Volk in Vancouver. He thought he was a Czech. And so he goes, you know, American kid trying to prove himself in Montreal. He drops the gloves, and Tom Chorsky was built like he was like a Greek god. And he just gets shit kicked by Gary Volk. And he's out, but nobody knows he's out. This is a concussion story. He goes to the penalty box, the game ends. We're all showering up and we're in the old Vancouver Coliseum getting dressed in the changing room beside our locker room. And he was putting his overcoat on as pants.
Oh no. Oh no. Oh Jesus.
And we're all start laughing because we think he's joking, but he's not.
He's out.
He's still out. And he's going, and Chor is going, what? Oh, and we're like, call the doctor, call the police.
Get the stretcher. Any favorite stories, Bobby, before we go? We didn't, you know, anyone putting pants on with their coat? Any of that jazz?
I can't remember any of that. Now you're putting me on the spot because I'm better when I'm let in, but I can't think of any. I'm good when I'm let in because something will come to mind, but I got nothing off the top of my mind.
I think apologize. The swimming in the lake with Kevin Dineen is pretty good.
Yeah, that is pretty good.
Yeah,
you shouldn't have stopped over.
It was only another 4 hours.
Kevin, I can't sleep. I'm just going to keep driving, okay? Yeah. No, really. I'm good.
Yeah, I'll be fine the next time. I'll tell you that. Yeah. Do it once.
Yeah, see you at camp.
Bobby, you're a remarkable guy, man. You're a remarkable guy. And I invite people to follow you and look at your story. And God, are you ever well-spoken. And what an attitude. What an attitude for... I know lots of guys who... don't get picked up by a team, and they're fucking bitter, man. They are bitter, but clearly that's not the case with you. And this is movie stuff, man, that your life is made of. So thanks a million for being so open and honest and funny.
Thank you. It's funny. You mentioned not getting picked up, but my wife said to me when I went to camp, she said, what do you hope for? And I said, the worst thing that can happen is I'm back with you guys in a day. That's it. I'm back in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and we're surfing or we're in Nashville. And if that's the worst thing that happens to me, that's the worst thing that happens to me. I can live with that.
Wow. Yeah. Fuck, are you cool? You're cool.
Yeah.
Cool, man. So,
good for you.
Carry on, Bobby, and good luck. We'll keep our fingers crossed. Maybe the Suspendables podcast will give you some karma, and someone will be knocking on the door tonight with a big contract.
Lots of money. All right. I'll take it.
and get your ass back out here. I know you're training, but let's have another round or two and get out here to Sherwood, and you can stay here with me and we can hang out for a few days. Or if you need I'm sure the family will want you to take a break and a road trip, get the hell out of their hair. So
yeah, no,
come to Sherwood.
Wife's itching for me to get on a plane. No, there we go. So, I'll let you know, pal. Good to see you guys. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Thank
you. Cheers, Bobby. Take care, man.
You too.
Thanks for being with us. Please be sure to subscribe to The Suspendables today and share the show with your friends and followers. And find out everything you need to know about the show on our brand new website, thesuspendables.com.